I'm going to today use today's lesson as an introduction to a Bible study that we're going to embark upon after this Sunday on Sunday mornings. This will introduce some things on the apostles, and we will go into more depth in class in Sundays after this, but I want to introduce these thoughts today. I like to call this any number of things. The apostles, who were these men? We could also call an unlikely team of 12. Also, we could call it the first team. You remember some time back I gave a sermon from Colossians chapter 4 on what I call the second team. That is, the second stringers, those who are not on the first string, but rather the second stringers. Well, today we're going to look at the first strings. These are the starters. These are the ones who we remember as prominent and first in terms of leadership in the early church, and the ones that Jesus called and worked with for those 3.5 years. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, we will kick off our lesson from these verses. Now, I would like for you to do one thing for me. In the handout, in the pew notes, the bulletin that you have, what I'd like for you to do on, you'll see a little question mark behind item 1 and item 2. Please scratch that out. Those are not questions. They are statements. What they endured and why they endured it. Now, the third one is a question, but please scratch out the question mark on numbers 1 and 2. And we're going to do some study of these men, and perhaps we'll draw closer to them in our knowledge and understand them better, and it will influence us and help us in our Christian lives. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul writes to this in verse 9, "For I think God has exhibited us apostles last of all, as men condemned to death, because we have become a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake, but you are prudent in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong. You are distinguished, but we are without honor. To this present hour, we are both hungry and thirsty, and are poorly clothed, and are roughly treated, and are homeless. And we toil, working with our own hands. When we are reviled, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure. And when we are slandered, we try to conciliate. We have become as the scum of the world, the dregs of all things, even until now." How about that? You ever read those verses closely? Have you ever looked at each statement that he makes about, notice, the apostles? The apostles. Let's take a look at what he has to say. I want to look at some of those words just for a moment. In verses 9 through 13, it says, I'm going to read from the King James. I just read from the New American Standard, but I'm going to read from the King James. "For I think that God has set forth us, the apostles, last." The word "set forth" in the Greek means the same idea as to exhibit gladiators. When gladiators were on the field of battle, they were being exhibited for all to see in the arena as they fought. And if we continue to move on, "as if it were appointed to death." Appointed to death means the idea of they were doomed. They were doomed. They were set forth as though you're watching gladiators, and they were doomed in terms of the overall plan of God. Notice he says, "I think that God has set forth." So God's at work here. God's in action here as to the role and the condition and the position and the struggles that these apostles faced. He says, "We are made a spectacle." The word "spectacle" is the word we get theater from. Theater from. So in other words, it's like people are watching a play with actors, and they're watching this play out in real men, real time, in real situations, and they weren't play acting, they weren't pretending, they weren't just learning and memorizing lines, they were living the reality of the struggle that they were in. He says, and to angels their spectacle unto the world, and to angels and to men, we are fools for Christ's sake. The word fool there means dull or sluggish. The idea where he uses this word of they were seen as though they were dull and as though they were sluggish. These are men who volunteered to be followers of Jesus, chosen by Jesus, and notice what it says about them. This is a graphic and a strong picture of these men as apostles. We are fools for Christ's sake, but you are wise. And he says, we are weak, but you're strong. You are honorable, but we are despised. Even unto, and the word despised means to be without honor, without honor. Even unto this present hour, we both hunger and thirst and are naked. And the word naked there means they were scantily clad. That is, they didn't wear warm, comfortable clothing all the time. There were situations they faced, probably in winter time, probably at sea, where they were not properly clothed. They were not properly attired to keep them warm and comfortable. Sometimes they were probably quite cold and uncomfortable in the circumstances that they were living in. He says they are buffeted. They are buffeted. Buffeted there is to be struck with the clenched fist. When someone buffeted them, it was to be like this, with their clenched fist. He says they were reviled. They were buffeted, having no certain dwelling place. That is, they were homeless. They did not have mortgages. They didn't have possessions very much. They were constantly on the go, constantly traveling, constantly preaching, constantly teaching, and constantly suffering for the cause of Jesus Christ. He says, and they labor, working with our own hands, being reviled. The word reviled there means to be abused. To be abused. And then he says, we bless. When they were being abused, they would bless back in return. Being persecuted, we suffer it, he says. Being defamed, we entreat. And when he says that we entreat, it means they beseeched, they comforted, they exhorted. Somebody defames them and slanders them and says ugly things about them. And what did they do? They blessed and they comforted and they helped and they wanted to be a blessing to those that did that. And then it says, we are made as the filth of the world. The word filth there means abject and despicable, scum and rubbish. This is how the apostles were seen. And then finally, the offscouring, he says, we are the offscouring of all things unto this day. And the word offscouring has a very interesting root. It says, this was treatment such as the lowest criminals would receive. Sometimes criminals would be forced to give their lives to expiate the sins of others. Now, that can't be done. A human being cannot expiate another's sins, but sometimes criminals were treated that way, even to the point they would be thrown overboard from a ship in order to release others from their sins. This was the superstitious way of thinking. So this is the picture that Paul drives here. He draws of the apostles. They're exhibited as gladiators. They're doomed. They're like a theater. They're dull and sluggish. They're without honor. They're scantily clad. When they are buffeted, they're struck with a clenched fist. They are reviled. They're abused. And he says, when these treatments come to them, they beseech and they comfort and they exhort, and they are viewed as scum and as rubbish and as trash to be thrown away. This These are the men that Jesus trained to follow him. Imagine that. Imagine these men. Who were these men? Who were these men? Why? What they endured. And that just mentions briefly the things that they endured in their travels. What was an apostle? An apostle was one who had been sent by Jesus. Jesus once said, "As the Father has sent me, so send I you." The Father sent Jesus with urgency, and Jesus sent his apostles with urgency. God sent. These men were God sent. There was a sense of urgency. Jesus came to earth. He died. He rose from the dead. Yet those facts would have been useless unless the world knows these facts. He entrusts much to this team. This team of 12, he gives a great deal of trust to so that they would spread the news of his death, his burial, and his resurrection. Did you know that Jesus, before he chose his apostles, he prayed all night. The day he chose his disciples had been after a night of prayer, an entire night of prayer. The seriousness of choosing these men was so great, so important, that he wanted the men who would be ready to endure great suffering for the cause of the gospel. These men even failed Jesus sometimes at his hour of great need. At his trial, all of his disciples forsook him. Thank you very much for that water. Thank you. His disciples failed him at his time of great need. They fled. Peter denied him 3 times at the time of his trial, and yet Jesus did not give up on his apostles. What Jesus did with them was he molded them, he made them into a team and commissioned them. In Jesus' prayer in John 17, he wanted his disciples to be one. As he and the Father were one, as he with his disciples, his apostles, was one, and then, of course, we, following centuries later, are to be one. In view of the description of the apostles by Paul, one wonders how they got the way they were. These were very human beings. They were people who had frailties and weaknesses and problems in their lives. But there was something about these men that Jesus was able to write upon. It was like a blank slate. They were from Galilee. Except for Judas, they were from Galilee. And they didn't have prejudices and preconceived notions about Jesus. They were slates upon which Jesus could write the truth. Of all the amazing works of Jesus, perhaps the most amazing and powerful was his ability to assemble a team of 12 men and forge them into an effective unit. What they went from to is absolutely amazing. These men weren't from religious groups. They were clean slates upon which he wrote. He started from scratch and worked from the ground up. These men had conflicts with each other. There were differences between them. But by walking with Jesus, they were changed and thus changed the world. Let me mention most of the disciples' names, the apostles' names. There was Peter, and I'm not going to go into detail upon Peter right now because we're going to look at that more in detail in our classes to come. There was Peter, also known as a stone. It was Simon, Simeon, Cephas, son of Jonah, and the word meant, Jonah meant dove, flutter, and timid. He was from Bethsaida. He was a fisherman. He did a noteworthy thing. Peter was the only one who rebuked his Lord. Can you imagine that? He rebuked the Lord in Matthew chapter 16. Who would have the boldness to rebuke the Lord? And yet Peter did. He was clear. He was powerful in his confession of Jesus. And he was, it looks like, a natural-born leader. Yet he had black marks recorded against him. He walked on the water, which was admirable, but then he sunk and was drenched in the brine. He denied Jesus at his great hour of need. He dissimulated when he gave in to the pressure from Judaizers in Galatians chapter 2. There was Andrew. Andrew means manly. He was Peter's brother, and he was a fisherman from Bethsaida. He was a finder. He went and found Jesus, and he found Peter to bring to meet with Jesus. He found the Messiah, and he found his brother to tell him about the Messiah. And the Greeks want to see Jesus, and it was Andrew who wants to make sure that that takes place. He seems to have had a thirst for the Lord, and one of the great admirable traits about Andrew was this. He was admirable because he had no envy in him and no jealousy whatsoever. His brother Peter receives much more press, much more notoriety than he does. And yet it was Andrew who found the Messiah first. And he brings Peter to the Messiah, and he's never envious of the attention paid to Peter later on in the ministry of Jesus. Peter becomes much more prominent than Andrew does, and yet Andrew never becomes envious or jealous over that fact. He was content to be a backup, in a sense. Then there was James. James was the English form of Jacob. He was probably older than John, and he was a fisherman. And he was associated with Peter, apparently in work. He was a neighbor in work. They were fishermen. Apparently their businesses, their fishing businesses were noteworthy. They were not failures. They were quite successful in their business, their fishing business. He has a hired servant in Mark chapter 1 and verse 20. And he's called by one who is a carpenter who has a better job for him to do. Notice, here's James, who is successful as a fisherman. A carpenter calls him, and he follows the carpenter. He was part of the special three intimate friends of Jesus, Peter, James, and John. And it was James who was first martyred. It was James who was first to be put to death for his faith, and that's in Acts chapter 12. Then there is John. You know, James and John were called the sons of thunder. They were passionate. They had deep feelings. They expressed those feelings very much. John and James were so very similar. Yet John, for all his fiery zeal and temper, is spoken of as being specially loved by Jesus. So you have James and John, the sons of thunder, and yet in one sense, very different men. James is put to death in Acts chapter 12. John apparently dies of old age, and he is the one that writes great letters on the subject of Christian love. They had strength. They were in some ways unpredictable. They had zeal that might approach even violence. But power that is not under the control of Jesus is useless, and Jesus learned to help them to learn to control their zeal, to control their temper, and bring it under usefulness to God. Philip, there was Philip, a lover of horses, which is what the name means. He was of Bethsaida also. He was a finder also. He was a finder of Nathanael. He was the one who was a questioner. He was a skeptic, a sense of the impossible. He was something of a pessimist. He was cautious and deliberate. There was Bartholomew, the son of Tolmai. Probably Nathanael, who tradition says may have taken the Gospel of Matthew to India. In Nathanael, we get a beautiful picture. He's fair-minded, he's open, he's expectant. He sat under a fig tree 15 feet high and 25 feet across, and he used it for prayer and meditation. He was thoughtful, and he was a discoverer. There was Thomas, which means twin. The man who became sure by doubting. We remember Thomas as doubting Thomas. And he gets criticized for that, but all Thomas wanted to know was, I want to see it before I believe it. And when he saw it, guess what he did? He believed it. He had the right kind of doubt. Many people have the wrong kind of doubt. It doesn't matter how much evidence you present to them, they are still going to doubt. But Thomas wasn't that way. Thomas was one who had an honest heart, and when he was shown the evidence, he would believe. He was the only one to stand with Jesus in danger while others are silent. That's John 11 and verse 16. Thomas was a man who seemed to be inquisitive, questioning with a weak faith after an early zeal. He was cautious, he was pessimistic, he was gloomy, yet he had courage and loyalty. Then there was Matthew. There was the Matthew who was the son of Alphaeus, which means the gift of Jehovah, the man that all men despised. He was a publican, a tax collector. You know, murderers, there was a phrase, murderers, robbers, and tax gatherers. That was the phrase, murderers, robbers, and tax gatherers. So imagine, in this group of 12, you have this tax collector, and he would have been hated. Jesus is taking all of these different personalities, these different men, these different backgrounds, and he's going to mold them into this wonderful team to work together for the sake of the gospel. I once knew someone who worked for the IRS, and when this person was asked, where do they work, they didn't say, I work for the IRS. They said, I work for the government. You know, self-explanatory. I knew a man who worked for the CIA. He would say the same thing. He worked for the CIA, and you ask him what he did, and he says, oh, I work for the government. That's all he would say. So Matthew, the man that all men despised, he wrote a gospel. He was a writer. He was a Jew in service to the Tetrarch of Galilee. Publicans were assumed to be guilty of dishonesty just by their profession. If you were a tax collector, people saw you and said, you're guilty, right off the bat, without even looking at the facts. Because you're a tax gatherer, you are guilty. They were barred from court as witnesses and as judges. And then there was Simon Zelotes. Simon Zelotes may have been a cousin of Jesus's, but we don't know for sure. He began by hating and ended up loving. Simon Zelotes was a political zealot. He was one who belonged to a party that believed in the militaristic, violent overthrow of Rome. And they were the terrorists of their day. In a sense, they would go about assassinating those who they felt were oppressing Israel. Simon Zelotes would be viewed as a political zealot today, and that's the kind of man that he was. He was a man who may have been accustomed to violence. He was part of the zealots. The zealots were a nationalistic party, zealous for the law and for the nation, and they were ultra-patriots against compromise. Simon Zelotes would have hated Matthew. Simon would have viewed Matthew as a traitor to the cause, because he's collecting taxes for Rome and he's against Rome. And yet Jesus takes these two conflicting characters and molds them together as part of this great team. He traded a dagger for a cross. And then there was James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and we don't know enough about them at this point. Now, what do I want to say about this? Why did these men put up with this? Why did they endure these things? What did they endure? They endured terrible, terrible sufferings. I talked about some of the words that Paul uses here with reference to the apostles. They saw the example of Jesus. They saw the response of Jesus when Jesus was criticized and hurt. They saw the resurrected Jesus. They saw their calling from Jesus. You know, the thing I want you to remember about the apostles is when you look at their lives and the suffering they went through, it was because they actually lived the Sermon on the Mount. Read the Sermon on the Mount closely, and you will see that his apostles took it literally. They lived the Sermon on the Mount. They loved their enemies. They treated those who persecuted them with love and compassion. Look at the things in the Sermon on the Mount, and you'll see it turns everything about the world upside down. The way the world thinks is different from the way Jesus thinks in the Sermon on the Mount. When the apostles went into a town or a city to preach, they didn't come in on white stallions with a sword in their hand saying, "You must listen to us." They went into towns as weak and as feeling vulnerable and threatened, and yet they kept teaching and preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. They gave up fame and fortune and comfort and power to be famous with God, to be enriched by God, to be comforted by God, to be powered by God. And when Paul says they are fools for Christ, here's my question. We're all fools for something. All of us. Whose fool are you? Whose fool are you? Because we're all fools for something. They were fools for Christ. Show me a church where its membership says, "We're going to be fools for Christ," and I'll show you a church that is going to take off like crazy. It's going to go crazy. Because nothing can stop that congregation. As it encounters the world, as it presents the gospel to the world, and people don't care. Mistreat me if you want me, if you want to. I will share the gospel with you, and I'll love you in return no matter what you do to me. Whose fool are you? Fool for being fools for Christ only is the way to live. Paul traded everything he had for Christ. Everything. He gave up his entire, his fame, his position, his prejudice, his power, all of the things that he had as a Pharisee, he gave them all up for the sake of Jesus, because he found in Jesus something more valuable than anything in the world that it has to offer. Finally, let me say this. In Acts chapter 4, when the first persecution against the church breaks out, and Peter and John and the apostles are told, "Stop preaching in his name." You know what their response was? "We can't help but speak. We cannot but speak. We have to speak. We must speak. There's nothing, to ask us to speak, to stop speaking, is like asking a fish to stop swimming. It's like asking a bird to stop flying. For them, to speak of Christ was as natural and normal and regular as life itself. And they couldn't give it up. And that's what these men were, these apostles. We're going to spend some time in Bible classes in the next couple of Sundays, and perhaps beyond there, where we're going to talk about these men more in detail and see what they went through. I want us to read again what Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, and then we'll close. He says, "For I think God has exhibited us apostles last of all as men condemned to death, because we have become a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake, but you are prudent in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong. You are distinguished, but we are without honor. To this present hour, we are both hungry and thirsty, and are poorly clothed, and are roughly treated, and are homeless, and we toil, working with our own hands. When we are reviled, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure. When we are slandered, we try to conciliate. We have become as the scum of the world, the dregs of all things, even until now." What they endured? Terrible things. Why did they endure it? Because they saw the risen Christ. And what do we learn? Maybe we can become a little like them. Become a Christian today, if you're not now. believe in Jesus, repent of sins, confess his name, and be baptized in water for the remission of sins. We have a chart right up here on the board. Come now while we stand and sing.